Let me tell you a little bit about Tyler Durden. Tyler was a night person. While the rest of us were sleeping, he worked. He had one part-time job as a projectionist. See, a movie doesn't come all on one big reel. It comes on a few. So someone has to be there to switch the projectors at the exact moment that one reel ends and the next one begins. If you look for it, you can see these little dots come into the upper right-hand corner of the screen.
In the industry, we call them cigarette burns.
That's the cue for a changeover. He flips the projectors, movie keeps right on going, and nobody in the audience has any idea.
Why would anyone want this shit job?
Because it affords him other interesting opportunities.
Like splicing single frames of pornography into family films.
So when the snooty cat and the courageous dog with the celebrity voices meet for the first time in Reel 3, that's when you'll catch a flash of Tyler's contribution to the film.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Ramblecast. I am your host, Chris Cesarano, and joining me this week is my brother, David Cesarano.
Hi.
And contributor, Joey.
What it do, pimps?
For those that aren't familiar, this is yet another episode of the Norwood Film Club. This is where I gather friends at my apartment, and we watch movies and then podcast about them, discuss them. This week, we were discussing Fight Club. And actually, first, I should also introduce the live studio audience, my droogs.
Yeah!
Hey!
Ow, ow!
Clerks is animated by a live studio audience.
There is a live studio audience.
So yeah, as I said, this week's episode was Fight Club. We watched Fight Club. Now, we are going to go right into discussing spoilers. We're not going to do recaps like the Now Playing podcast or Quarter to Three movie podcast. So if you're not familiar with Fight Club, then either you're just going to hear a bunch of spoilers that you're not sure what the hell's going on, or you're going to need to kind of watch the film first.
That being said, there's going to be a lot of stuff that can be left up to interpretation. So, I mean, you know, proceed with caution.
Yes.
It's kind of cool how this movie works.
Yeah, and that's actually the funny thing is I was kind of wondering where to start. Like, normally I come up, or I try to come up with talking points so people can have things in their mind when they watch the movie. This one was hard because it's like, well, what do you start with? What kind of thing do you ask people to really think about, because there's so much, and even if you try and go broad, it's like, well, there's like five different things this movie could be about. And I guess that's where I'm going to start with, is to me personally, because I know the big joke is, you know, Fight Club is not a movie about fighting, but the thing is, the next interpretation would be more or less that it's about things like consumerism and all that. But I think at its center, at its core, Fight Club is really a movie about finding identity and meaning in life, because that's where a lot of the characters are coming together. They're trying to find some kind of, that's the thing, not even the characters, it's the background characters, the side characters, they're all trying to find some kind of meaning, and even our protagonist is trying to find meaning in his own life, and instead what there's all this stuff that kind of contradicts it. Everything that Tyler Durden kind of spouts is kind of contradicting itself and kind of contradicting the idea of, you know, finding your own life as well. So that's generally my kind of core interpretation, though there to say it's just about that is an oversimplification. Dave, Joey, what would you guys say on that matter? Like, what would you think on this game, movies?
You want to go first, Joey?
Sure, I'll go first. Before I begin, I'm going to say that, in, like, straight through in its entirety, this is the first time I've actually seen the movie in one sitting. I've seen bits and pieces of it over the course of a very short period of time when I was much younger. So it was kind of like watching it from the beginning, brand new. It was like a new experience. That being said, I was already aware of a lot of spoilers, but what I found it to be a lot about outside of finding purpose, finding meaning, and trying to see where you belong, I found it to be a lot about mental disorder. And that's probably the most obvious thing, but I don't know if this was like multiple personality disorder or something like that, but I remember hearing the a symptom of schizophrenia being like you see people at like the corner of your eye, and that's what was happening in the movie in the very beginning. And if I recall correctly, they were pictures or like still shots of Tyler Durden. And if you blinked, you missed it. So I thought that was fascinating how they managed to capture that. It was almost like seeing the world through the eyes of someone who was going through such a disorder.
And each blink of Tyler Durden in the beginning was at a very key moment of dialogue as well.
Absolutely.
The first one being, you know, when he's talking about a copy of a copy. The second one, when the guy's sitting there, you know, you want to see pain go down to First Methodist, and it's, you want to see pain, boom, Tyler flashes in. And then in that meeting at the testicular cancer meeting, I forgot what the guy said.
I look around the room, I see a lot of courage, and something about, like, you know, we give each other strength, and boom, he pops in right there.
Something along those lines, yeah.
And the next time he pops in is when Marla Singer is walking away after they divvied up. No, they haven't divvied it up yet.
I don't remember him popping up there.
But she
I must have blinked and missed.
She's walking away, and he glances in her direction, and then you,
he pops in like in the bottom corner, as if it's in the corner of your eye.
You gotta actually be looking at Marla Singer walking away, instead of at him, the protagonist. Just for a moment, can we just agree to call him Jack?
Because this calm Jack.
I'm Jack's raging bile duct, things like that. Like a lot of people who've discussed the book and the movie refer to him by the name that comes up in those articles. So,
and you know what? That's actually a very interesting thing you bring up. Is unlike me and Joey, you've also read the book, and you haven't read it in a while. But
I've also read Choke by Chuck Palahniuk as well.
So you're more familiar with the author's work as well as seeing the film.
What's interesting also is both movies or both books. What's interesting is that both books they deal, at least in a cursory level, with self-help groups, because the main character of Choke also, he ends up, he's a sex addict, and he goes to a Sex Addicts Anonymous group. And while Jack goes to, in Fight Club, he goes to a whole bunch of different groups as well. So it's one of those things, I think, that it popped up in both of the books. Now, unfortunately, I haven't read anything else by Chuck Palahniuk. I haven't read Lullaby or any of that stuff. I want to, but just never got around to it.
Also, I want to point out that since we're calling him Jack, he refers to himself occasionally as Jack. I like how they picked that, because Jack is a very
common name.
Yeah, it's a very common everyman nobody kind of name. I remember didn't they call Snake that in Metal Gear or something like that?
Oh no! That was
they called him Plissken.
Plissken, which
that's a reference to Snake Plissken.
Well, yeah.
Escape from New York and Escape from L.A.
I could have sworn the third one, they called him Jack at some point, but he was... And that name ended up being not important at all.
Master Chief's name is John.
Wasn't Raiden named Jack? Or at least that was part of...
Raiden's
name is Jack.
Yeah.
So...
But he becomes somebody. Anyway. Anyway, now we're straying.
Really what they're doing there is trying to represent... I think what they're trying to do there is trying to make that protagonist be that everyman type. Again, reinforce the everyman perspective with the protagonist.
And that is very much what Edward Norton's character is, what Jack is, because if you... I mean, Tyler Durden says it himself later on that, you know, he himself is Jack's idealization of himself, essentially. That he is what Jack essentially wants to be. And when you get right down to it, he really is. I mean, they got an actor like Brad Pitt intentionally, the kind of actor that's going to be on, you know, like top sexiest man alive.
Yeah,
The heartthrob. I mean, granted, they got one that's an actually good actor, but he's got the stylish haircut. When we first meet him, he's got the stylish jacket, the stylish shades. I mean,
he stands out. He's flamboyant.
And everything, I mean, that's the thing, even if it might not even be quote-unquote fashionable, it's still a style. It's not wearing your cog-in-the-machine, white-collar shirt and tie. He's got something that's got style, flair to it. So Tyler Durden is an idealization of a man, and he himself, like the most that Jack really has going for him is he's buying these designer clothing, like these designer ties, designer shirts, designer pants that the world tells him he should have.
But they're all not unique. They're all cookie cutter. They're all stamped out. They're all business, you know.
Clothing that's supposed to say me, and yet it's saying everyone else.
Yeah. I think what's also interesting is how Tyler Durden is not just the idealization of a man, but he's the idealization of an empowered man, a self-empowered man. He...
Superman.
Yeah.
Kind of. And Superman.
Very much he's like a Superman. He's an Ubermensch. He is... which is funny, we mentioned Ubermensch.
In Batman, yeah.
About Batman, too.
And, is this going to be a theme?
No. Probably not.
I don't know, maybe Scott Pilgrim versus the World will be, I don't know.
But I also want to point out very, very much that this movie is a product of its time. And I'm not talking about just the 1990s, but just the past, I'd say, 20 years in American society, the past generation, because it's really at the dawn of when the postmodern, post-feminist man comes of age, and some of the things that he talks about in the film, like, you know, many of us men are products of divorce, and we're a generation of men raised by women, and it was really like our generation, because I myself am in my mid to late 30s, and I was in my 20, just turning 20 when the movie came out, and this movie really discusses some of the side effects of the divorce culture that has taken over. You know, I mean, 50% of marriages, statistically, they say, end in divorce. That means 50% of men born after a certain time period are being raised with distant or absentee fathers or shared custody. And, you know, a father they're not in their father's home every day. Their exposure to their father's being limited. So this is very much, they don't have role models. And one of the things that Tyler, produces for these men, he provides for these men, is a role model, is a father. And there's so much, paternal symbolism and paternal behaviors that Tyler Durden has. For example, when he's about to walk out and franchise, and Jack is in bed, and he says, get better, champ, and he pats him on his head, and then he walks out the door. The imagery is one of a father leaving and not coming back.
And Tyler himself is even kind of silhouetted in a way that, I mean, for a young man that goes through an experience like that, he might not have a clear memory of his father.
Yeah.
So he sees Tyler silhouetted, and when he walks away, like, the camera's at an angle where it intentionally makes Tyler look tall, too.
I think it's very important also to point out that this is not a movie that's aimed at every audience, and the book itself is not a book that's aimed at every audience. This is a book for and about men. You know, it's not, and I'm not saying, like, I'm not making any judgments here or anything. I mean, like, you're not gonna, Mystic Pizza and the Sisterhood of Traveling Pants is not a movie for me. I'm a guy. Okay. It's not like I'm going to go watch one of those movies and really get something out of it. I mean, I might be able to appreciate it on certain levels, but it's not going to speak to me the way a movie for, by, and about men is going to speak to me. And Fight Club, both the book and the novel, is by a man, it's for men, and it's about men. And it's about the, I guess you could say, the postmodern masculine condition, which is one of emasculation and listlessness and not knowing what to do with themselves.
I'm going to expand on your point there. Robert Paulson himself had the boobs and the estrogen problems and all that.
What they called the bitch tits.
Yeah. Yeah. The bitch tits.
And I'll actually touch more on Robert Paulson, but I also wanted to say, at the risk of entering controversial territory, but I do also want to say that this analysis of the material does not necessarily speak for personal opinion, yada, yada, yada. But you can even, if you want to look back even on, especially the 90s, talk about a generation of men raised by women, also think about going through our own childhood. How often was it when we read about, you know, violence in video games? And you and me especially, considering growing up in a Christian household and having to deal with turmoil in a toy box and other things like that.
Oh, yeah, Skeletor was, you know, the devil and all that.
And how much of this stuff... How much of this stuff gets... was perpetuated by specifically mom groups. It's usually moms against something, something, something.
Yeah.
And a lot of that was during the 90s and...
Well, that was more during the 80s.
The PMRC. Look
the,
that
the
up.
The Satanic Panic. Oh, yeah. The PMRC, Tipper Gore. Oh, yeah. I'm gonna...
But, I mean, a lot of... But even during the 90s, I mean, even though, you know, that was starting to get more into the working mother and everything, but there was still... Especially, I remember for us, like, there was still, you know, the mom was a much greater presence, and the father was kind of, you know, the breadwinner that, you know, goes to work, comes home, sits down, and just watches TV kind of a thing.
Well, that's also something that was really developing in television as well. I mean, before this, if you see, like, early 80s sitcoms, like Family Ties, I think it was, with Michael J. Fox, and it's funny because his parents were hippies, and he plays a young Republican. And the Reagan era, amazing. But it's still like one of those, you know, white picket fence, mom and dad, and father is going to give wisdom and advice to his son.
It was the standard American stereotype.
Yeah, it was, even though the parents were, you know, extremely left wing and the son was extremely right wing. But then you get married with children and boom, everything changes.
And The
Simpsons.
The Simpsons would have never succeeded without Married with Children. But, you know, now all of a sudden it's like, okay, the father is an asshole. He's stupid. He's dumb. He can't think for himself. And it's up to the women in his life to fix everything. And this is the message that these men are growing up with. Like, we're dumb. We're stupid. We're this. We're that.
We get told,
speak for yourself. I'm the one here with two master's degrees. Anyway. I am not stupid.
Are any of them in Spanish? Any of them in Spanish?
Cranial penis measuring contest.
Again, that's something that's, you know, that's not.
But no, I mean the core
of
it,
one upping each other is somewhat of a manly thing.
Oh, it totally is. It's also very sibling thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's also, you don't take it too seriously.
Yeah. And here's the thing, though. In the context of the film of Fight Club, think about, and again, let's go back to Robert Paulson, Bitch Tits, Bob, you know.
Yeah.
Where do they meet him? They meet him at a testicular cancer, you know, men that are losing
their manhood.
He's been castrated. And he emasculated, and those two things are very much in traditional speak, very synonymous.
And think about the very first confession we hear in that testicular cancer is from a man that's talking about how he and his wife, you know, they always wanted kids, could never agree with who, and he's discussing how his wife had her first kid with another man. But and very much
down and cries, and he says it's because, you know,
she deserves I'm happy for her, even though he's clearly not. And then what is Fight Club, though? Fight Club is a very different sort of, and it's raw masculinity. It is men punching the shit out of each other, and just
barbaric,
like
barbaric, even wow. it is like going back to our human roots.
But these men are given a chance, and that's the thing. Like, Bob is sitting there hugging Jack, saying, "We're still men," but he's crying as he's doing it. And at the end of some of the fight, like when you get to the later parts of the movie, you see after these guys fight, they get up, they hug, and they're not quite crying, but they're happy.
They are, yeah. There's like, well, the one is definitely crying while he hugs the other guy,
but he's smiling.
Yeah, it's like this kind of rapture. Like, well, what it is it's the building of brotherhood. I mean, I've gotten, when I was in grade school, I got in a lot of fights, and a lot of those fights resulted in me being very close friends with the other person. And it's
just a kind of respect that kind of emerges from it. Yeah. Even some kind of release of tension. You know, you can even say that this is kind of a, in some twisted way, a some kind of weird sexualization of men.
There's nothing weird about it.
Yeah, yeah. No. Awkward silence.
What I'm saying is that the Nazis capitalized on it explicitly in their propaganda, and that's a relatively basic part of basic training. I mean, it's not that it is homoerotic, although there are hints or suggestions of it quite a lot. But yeah, it is a release. It is catharsis, mm-hmm. of a sort. I mean, Jack at the beginning, sleep debt. You're talking about schizophrenia.
Right.
He's clearly not balanced at the beginning of the movie.
He's not well in any way, shape, or form.
And a lot of it is the stress. He can't sleep because of work, because he's already been emasculated by the system.
Yes.
So yeah. It's...
what makes him feel like a man again? Fighting.
I'd like to go off on his point. Speaking of Edward Norton's character, I think we really need to give credit to Edward Norton here in this movie.
Yeah.
Because I think one thing that he really does well is he really gets into his character and he really presents them well. Because I think we can all agree that whenever we want to see a movie, and that's any movie, I mean, sure, every movie has its CGI effects, namely every Michael Bay movie out there. But we all want to see, like, we all want to believe the characters. We all want to understand the characters. And we all want to see them have strong character development. Like, Edward Norton plays a very mentally troubled person, which I think he clearly does very well. And I don't know if he was nominated for an Oscar for this movie, but he definitely should have.
I doubt he
would really piss the Academy off.
Yeah, it would.
Yeah, I mean, it's very politically incorrect in a lot of ways.
But even further than that, though, I mean, one of the things that... I mean...
But socially, I say, especially for its time, it was spot on. It brought a lot of things to the table that, at the time, we did not discuss very much. And now with the advent of the internet, we talk about it pretty often.
Yeah.
Like, perhaps not most intelligently, but...
No.
Certain groups, I mean, you know, but...
Well, the Academy is socially comatose, so...
Yeah. we can't really consider that.
Well, they can't hear us because they're too busy listening to their money.
Our money.
Our money. I'm sorry. Yeah. Our money.
Scrooge McDuck. Anyways, going back to the film, though, and of course, I mean, I think all the actors, and I'll say, too, Edward Norton and David Fincher both do an incredible job of filming Edward Norton kicking his own ass.
I mean,
give it up to Jim Carrey in Liar Liar, but he does not hold a candle to Edward Norton giving himself an uppercut and landing on a glass table.
Yeah. Broken nose.
Broken face, honestly.
Broken everything. It was surprisingly convincing to watch.
Yeah.
And it looked painful. So...
A especially lot like, of this movie looks painful.
Yeah. Like picking himself up with his own shirt.
Yeah.
It looked like that... I don't know if they had, like, a wire or something, but it definitely looked like there was a lot of power behind... Like, dude, you can't pull yourself up by your own collar. It's very
unless
difficult.
You're really believing it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, again, like, Edward Norton and anything David Fincher did, like, the two of them. And, of course, one of the things I actually did start to pick up on, because I was thinking about it, there is an awful lot of narration in this film, and usually that can be a really bad idea. But I started to notice that very little of what what Jack is narrating is going hand in hand with what's on screen. I mean, in a literal way.
He's giving background information.
He's giving background information. And it usually works with what you're seeing on screen, but they're not telling you what you're seeing, kind of a thing. And he's not telling you what he's feeling or thinking at that very moment. It is a very... excellent use of combining narration with the art of film, so he's able to take some of Chuck Palahniuk's voice, take some of that, apply it to the film to strengthen the film, while he's also using the visual language of film to enhance it in its own right. So it's really working what's strong about the book, which is going to be the voice of the protagonist, well together with visually telling the events and getting stuff that you might not be able to get. Like, I can't imagine how in the book that fight at the end really comes off. But I know, and actually, Dave, like, let's go back to...
It's been a long time since it's been so long since I've read the book that I really don't recall how that part went out.
But even then, I mean, let's also go back, because you observed it, of course, and it's kind of, like, comedic when it happens, but going even back to idealization... You know, every time Edward, I mean Jack, fights with Tyler Durden, it looks like two guys fighting. It looks plausible. There's nothing Hollywood about it. I mean, the first punch thrown is in Tyler Durden's fucking ear.
Yeah.
And then the next blow is just to the stomach, and then they like fight. Like, it looks like two guys really in a scrap.
A very, very crappy, not spectacular, non-Hollywood scrap. It's like you actually went to a bar, went outside,
and saw a fight.
Yeah, and saw just some just two dumb dudes fighting.
And
that's the first time it's filmed.
It's the very
second time the same scene is filmed. Just Norton, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Well, you get bare glimpses of it though too.
Well, what I was going towards though was towards the end. Then when they're at the van, the last fight he has, all of a sudden Jack is afraid of Tyler Durden, and what happens to Tyler Durden's fighting style? I mean, it's kind of comedic, but. It's Bruce Lee.
Yeah.
And some of it, you know.
That one thing is taken directly from the Game of Death where he, like, stomps down and
twists. And Brad Pitt does it perfectly. Yeah. So, I mean, this is the movie that made me realize Brad Pitt was a really good actor. So, but even then, it's like all of a sudden he's pulling out these flashy moves and everything. And not all of it. A lot of it's still kind of practical stuff, but.
He's showing off and playing with
it. He's showing off. And that's the thing. Like, now he's something frightening. Now he's something he's seen out of the movies. Now Tyler Durden is
Brad Pitt Bruce Lee. Kicking ass.
It was Brad Pitt kicking ass, but he's Bruce Lee. So these are all mental manifestations of the protagonist. Here he is an idealization of something that can fight well, and it's coming up when Jack is now frightened of Tyler Durden, as opposed to before where he thought Tyler Durden was just a normal guy.
A normal guy, and then as the movie goes along, just turns into an asshole.
And so I think it's interesting at the end, where, and I actually read some articles about this too, at the end when he puts the gun in his mouth and shoots himself, effectively killing Tyler Durden, we presume as the audience, okay, he just killed himself, he's dead. But then, later, when Helena Carter's character, I forget what her name
is. From the bottom, Marla.
She comes, well, he just stands up like everything's okay. So you have to wonder, and I think, to some degree, a little bit is left to a user interpretation of that. Was he really still alive? Or in reality, was he dead? And did he get back up?
Oh, Jesus.
No, well, he shot himself through the side of the mouth.
Yeah, it didn't kid me. It didn't hit anything vital, but it was enough to. I don't know, the way he talks to the space monkeys that come up through the stairs, well, that's what the book refers to them as. I do remember that much. The book refers to them as the space monkeys. When the space monkeys bring Marla through the elevator, and he stands up and he commands them and he tells them what to do and he's in control and he's Tyler Durden. And I think what happened there is Jack accepted Tyler Durden into himself as well as killed him. So it's kind of like, he killed Tyler Durden as an alter ego, but then just kind of accepted that, okay, yes, this is what I've done. This is, because responsibility isn't really a part of the movie until the very end, where Tyler says, take some responsibility. And now he's kind of just accepted what he's done. I've done this. I've blown these buildings up. I've, you know, reset the clock. I've done all these things, and I'm in charge of the space monkeys, but I'm still Jack.
When we're talking about the fighting hell, their fighting styles did improve, though.
Yes,
both.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Everything changed, and then you don't actually see him shirtless until he's, you know, carved wood, as he said in the movie. Mm-hmm.
Like, it went in from the beginning where Edward Norton's character, imagine Brad Pitt's character, he wanted him to hit him as hard in the face as he could. And Edward Norton was like, what? What are you talking about? Well, then throughout the movie, it no longer became, what are you talking about? They just did it. They just went at it, mm-hmm. and it got more bloody, more brutal. Which, by the way, this movie was rated PG, right?
I think it's R. It's a hard R.
It
became a huge acceptance into their life, and in fact became a normality of their life, just to beat the shit out of each other.
One interesting thing about accepting responsibility, it's also tied into accepting the consequences of what you've done. He now has, his alter ego did this whole aspect of building this group, now he's got to take responsibility for it, he's got to accept the consequences of being a leader. The funny thing is that this whole entire thing, it's this discussion about, you know, trying to make your own identity and, like, not having the father figure in your family. One big thing that often comes up when you're talking about masculinity and having father figure, finding your place, is also growing up. Growing up and becoming more responsible. That was a good theme in this as well. And this whole process may have been some really messed up and attempt of really trying to have a rite of passage to become an actual man and adult, maybe. It feels like there's a little bit of that in this story, actually, in the whole progression. Mm-hmm. He's trying to, like you said, finding that identity, but then trying to have that be able to feel worthy of being whoever he wants to be.
Yeah.
He never really accepted, he could never accept the fact that he had done all this stuff as Tyler Durden. It was always an alter ego. It was always the ideal person. He could never be like this. He didn't have it in him to be that way, so it makes no freaking sense. He always needed that crutch of that mental image of Tyler Durden. So, it's like, there's this aspect of, like, how do I know I am who I am, or I know I have the ability to do this? Oftentimes, in a lot of other cultures, there's this rite of passage. If we want to talk about this being a product of, you know, our time as well, in the United States, in the U.S., our culture, we don't really have that type of tradition. Not in many types, maybe in smaller pockets of, you know, different cultures within the United States, but as a whole, it's not wrong that we're so homogenous, but we just don't have that national identity, that national thought of, you know, having that rite of passage. You probably could say that with, you know, getting your license or getting your diploma or anything like that could be that way, but
there's a degree of superficiality to all those things. Like, I get my driver's license. I lived in a country where I didn't need one for 3 years, but here it's not just a rite of passage; it's almost a necessity. And I mean, I can see this how it's superfluous, not just necessarily. I mean, to me, a license isn't, you know, a rite of passage. It's just kind of optional.
It's a privilege.
Well, that's what they say. Yeah. That's what they say. Functionally, if you don't have a license, good luck finding a job. But that's kind of beside the point. What I mean is, you know, the rites of passage that we have are, well, one of the huge themes of the movie is consumerism. And what is the rite of passage? Go to college, get a job, get married. Those are the things that Tyler Durden / Jack's father told him as they're talking when Tyler's taking a bath and, you know, he's clipping his Jack's clipping his nails. And they're having this conversation about what their dad did. And they don't realize it at the time. Well, Jack doesn't realize it at the time. But they're talking about the same man. And so he says these, you know, okay, I went to college. What do I do now? I don't know. Get a job. Okay, I got a job. What do I do now? I don't know. Get married.
And that's the thing. It's always prefaced with, I don't know. Like,
yeah.
Like, the dad doesn't even know. Like, the dad's still figuring out.
Yeah, the dad's still figuring out. The dad's still a kid. The dad's still immature. And so these men have no role model. They don't have anybody to look up to. So when Tyler comes up and he's got a plan and he's charismatic and he's got all these things and he can point men in the direction and give them meaning. I mean, one of the things he's saying to them is, you are not your job. You're not your khakis. You're not these physical things, these consumerist identity things that really don't have any meaning. They don't explain who you are. They just explain who you're paying to advertise for. And you know, you want to say something? Go ahead.
There's also an aspect of self-loathing in there. And Tyler Durden tears down a lot of what Jack already believes about himself.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that he intentionally destroyed... Like, and that's the thing. Going back to some of what Dave was saying... Going back to what my Droog was saying.
Yeah, there's two Daves in here.
To keep this from being a little too confusing.
There's another one in the other room.
Okay, and that's the thing. Going back to what he said, throughout the entire movie, Jack is struggling with, like, he wants to follow Tyler Durden. He realizes that a lot of this stuff is bullshit, but he's still struggling with it. Like, you know... He sarcastically says, you know, I want to thank the Academy after he tells the cop, you know, that condo was my life, because he's realizing it wasn't, but there's still partial truth to it, because Jack is still in some ways tied to his societal programming. He doesn't want to have the chemical burner on his hand. He thinks it's terrible. He thinks it's chaotic. He's not ready to just let go. And in the car, he's still not ready to let go. He's not ready to let go, and Tyler is basically sitting there like, are you ready to, like, and trying to get him to confess. It's like, if you were to die, and that's actually the funny thing. Again, this is all because Jack, realized, you know, nothing in his life has given him satisfaction. Where can he find that satisfaction? Where can he find that meaning? And what is everything Tyler Durden is saying? You have no meaning. You are not special. It's a complete rebellion, and yet it's also counter to the journey that all of these men are all together going on. The journey to find some kind of meaning in your life. They're all looking for meaning, but they're being told they're nothing. Because what are they trying to find meaning? If they can't find meaning in their own lives, they're trying to find meaning in being a part of Project Mayhem. Or being a part of Fight Club. Like, and even creating something like Fight Club. That is what Jack is trying to do, and Tyler Durden keeps taking it further.
Well, they're finding meaning in the collective. They're finding meaning in camaraderie. I mean, this is something where...
Basic training.
Yeah, exactly. It's basic training. Do you remember, Chris? I have two things I want to mention. I do want to mention that you mentioned that the chemical burn in the shape of a kiss on Jack and Tyler's hands that Tyler put on Jack's hand.
Never thought of that about him in the shape of a kiss.
Yeah, it's a kiss because he kisses his hand, and that's throughout the book it refers to them as Tyler's kiss. So these men carried Tyler's kiss. Well, that was a rite of passage. The near-life experience, which they talk about a little bit more in depth about near-life experiences in the book, that was a rite of passage, going, you know, to what the Drew was saying.
Which I thought was really odd, because the usual statement is near-death experience.
Yeah, yeah.
No, that's the intention.
The point. That's the point, yeah.
You're living in that moment kind of thing.
Well, like, okay, yeah. I mean, finding these guys are finding meaning. They're finding meaning in the collective. They're finding meaning in the group. They're finding meaning in, like, basic training. And if you remember, Chris, do you remember the Rome miniseries?
The Rome miniseries, yes.
Yeah, the HBO Rome miniseries. Do you remember the scene where Titus Pullo is thrown into the gladiatorial arena as a death sentence?
13.
And, yeah, when he fights off all the gladiators, and then he's, you know, he's exhausted, and he's about to get killed by the one, and then Lucius Farinus jumps in, pulls a gladius, and starts beating the crap out of all these other gladiators, and basically it's him and Titus Pullo exhausted with blood all over them, bloody swords and bodies and body parts all around them, and they just start cheering their legion's number. 13! 13! 13! And man, I would be hard-pressed to think of any man who would watch that and not get teary-eyed. I mean, I did. I teared up.
It is a wonderful moment, and it is very specifically calling back to, for these guys, they are a part of something no one else will understand.
Yes.
And Fight Club, you're right, that's kind of what Fight Club is. Like, you do not understand it unless you're a part of it.
Yeah, it's that camaraderie that soldiers get, that people who've been through a lot of difficult things get. They have a common purpose, they have a common leader, they have common goals. And so they are part of something that knits them together extremely tightly that outsiders just won't comprehend. And so that gives them meaning. And it's not just the fact that they're doing it for Tyler Durden, although he's, through his charisma and through his speeches and the way he talks, he galvanizes them. He creates himself as a center around which they can all orbit. He is a role model for them. They all can look up to him. They want to be him. And that also makes an effective leader. If you're going to be a good leader, you want your men to not only love you, you want your men to be willing to do anything for you. You want your men to want to be you. They want to admire you and they want to emulate you.
It's very much like a, I guess like a messiah kind of figure.
Yeah, he's setting himself up very much as a messiah. And so you lose your individuality, but these guys kind of chose to. And that's also part of it. I mean, because one of the things he says is, Tyler calls into question, well, what good was your individuality anyway? It was an illusion. Our Great Depression is our lives, he says. You know, and you're not your khakis. You're not your job. You're not this. You're not the magical little snowflake that your school teacher told you you were. You don't get a trophy for participation. Sorry. You know, and these harsh realities, you know, the fact that basically men have been lied to for an entire generation. And now they're waking up to it, and they don't have, as of the late 90s, men were waking up to it, And now they're realizing, well, what the hell is life about? It's not about everything that everybody told me, because this is not fulfilling. It's empty. And then Tyler gives them this meaning. So now that they've got this meaning, they can do stuff. They can be a part of something that's bigger than themselves.
See, that's there are a number of juxtapositions in the story in the first place. And the first one, I think, would be the fact that where they're starting from is they're already part of a collective that's bigger than them. But they see it as destroying and obliterating their individuality.
Mm-hmm.
So then to get their individuality back by abandoning their commercialism and their IKEA apartments and their khakis, they join Fight Club, which they can't discuss. And then that turns into Project Mayhem.
Yes.
Where they have no names.
But here's
until
the funny
they
thing.
Die.
Here's the funny thing about the whole, the first rule about Fight Club is you can't. It introduces an element of exclusivity. And the funny thing is, we could follow this up with the Social Network, because that's a key element there, too. Another David Fincher film. Mm-hmm. And one of the key things is, there's one thing to be part of a collective, but once it's an exclusive collective, again, it becomes that brotherhood.
Mm-hmm.
That thing where it's a shared element that other people don't understand, and therefore there is, even if it's also an illusion, even if it's also artificial, now it has meaning to you, because other people will not understand. And as Jack even notes when he's, walking out, he says, after the one day he gets chewed out by his boss because he finds the Fight Club rules, Jack's like, I'm acting rude to people, but he's like, I am enlightened.
Yeah.
And it's said partially sarcastically, and it's said partially very conceitedly, because it is something these guys believe.
Was that the first scene where he also says Tyler's words coming out of my mouth?
Yes.
Yes.
Mm.
Right?
Yeah.
So it's... I'm not sure if that's the disassociation or if that's the reassociation, because like we've also talked about, near the end of the movie, Jack starts fearing Tyler after Tyler has revealed that
they're the same
Tyler.
Guy, yeah.
Right. So there's that question of schizophrenia coming up again. But also the thing is with the exclusive collectivity, what's it, Tyler is Nietzschean. He's the Nietzschean Superman.
Yeah.
Ignore all the rules you've been given. Make up your own reality. But the thing is, one, the reality is destructive. I mean, they're not making stuff. And most people think Nietzsche's a nihilist. So, and I think I see that coming through in this. I'm not sure about the other Palahniuk books. But the thing is, Nietzsche's not a nihilist. He's a hedonist. Which actually sort of feeds into the whole beginning of the IKEA collective. So it's, in some ways, the story itself is a little schizophrenic.
Could you give a quick definition of hedonist?
Hedonism is basically just seeking pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
And nihilism is, of course, seeking cessation, nirvana, destruction.
Yeah, kind of.
And the thing is, Nietzsche was talking about Superman making up his own rules so that he could live a free life as his own man. That's hedonism, not I want to be my own man so I can destroy myself. That's nihilism.
Actually,
so it's...
Yeah, I see where you're going with that, because with Fight Club, it's really, if you look at it, all these people are giving up their civility to become uncivil. The whole entire fight, there is a rule. You stop until, the person passes out, or until, person gives up, they tap. But there was a point where Jack, he was getting, really upset that nobody else was giving him attention or giving him, or he kept on saying, Tyler Durden did all this stuff.
Jealousy.
Yeah, Jack started getting jealous, and then he got to a point where he took the one guy with the blonde hair, the really pretty guy.
Babyface, I believe he's called in the book.
Yeah. He beat the freaking crap out of him.
He made him ugly.
He made him ugly. It's like, and he even said,
that scene in the book, though, is just...
worse.
It's incredibly powerful, because Jack at this point is mad about a lot of stuff, and you only get a glimpse of it where he talks about, I want to put a bullet between the eyes of every panda that won't screw to save his species. I want to open up all the valves on oil tankers and drown all the French beaches in oil that I'll never see. And there's a couple other things he talks about in that scene. And while he's destroying something beautiful, it's like, oh my God, I have a power to destroy something beautiful, and it will never be beautiful again. but it's, he's exerting agency. He does not have any agency, and he's a, it's like, well, that's part of the problem with throughout the movie, is he feels like he doesn't have any agency. And now he does. He has agency. He can change the world by destroying something. And he destroys Babyface.
It's really weird, too, because that's...
Well, Wilmington, too.
If you think about it, if you think about it too, there's... when that scene was ending, what did Tyler Durden say? He called him a bully. And if you think about it, that's like, well, that whole entire scene, that's what a bully does.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they're destroying something because, I guess, you know, again, they don't feel like they can change anything. They're in a...
Well, yeah, I actually, also the fatherlessness and the generational things. The father that Jack and Tyler are discussing, one of those baby boomers, mm-hmm. you know, the people who changed the world in the '60s for the little guy.
Yeah,
and then by the 1980s, we had Michael Keaton starring in Big City Bright Lights. You know, the Coke generation. So the lessons that they left Jack's generation were pretty empty and vapid. Yeah. And that's the whole thing with the IKEA catalog at the beginning. That's my individuality. I can pick these four pieces instead of those four pieces.
I get the coffee table with a yin-yang because that speaks to me somehow.
Yeah.
It's funny because it actually does.
And of course...
which is great. I thought that was a really,
actually,
really nice touch.
You know what? That is a really nice touch for this movie, actually.
And don't you see it outside just completely destroyed?
Yes. Yeah. Yep. Yes. Mm-hmm.
So, like...
Next to the ketchup bottle.
Yeah, the refrigerator full of condiments and no food. Yeah. I mean, it actually shows him...
That's a metaphor for superficiality.
Wow.
There's no meat in the fridge.
And again, Edward Norton's job. Like, Edward Norton's great job. Because just the delivery is like, how embarrassing. Like, he says it like... That's how he's supposed to feel, but he doesn't really give a shit.
Oh, he's so monotone at the beginning of the movie. He's just almost emotionless as he's delivering all these lines. All that emotion starts coming later in the film.
It's very it's very sociopathic. Mm-hmm. Very sociopathic.
There is one thing though that I do want to point out, and none of us have talked about it yet, but it's the only woman character in the movie. I mean, there are other women that float in and out, like Chloe's. I think one of the only other named females in the movie, but Marla. Marla is not a foil for all of womanhood in this film. I don't think she is at all. Foil's the wrong word. She's not a representation of all of womanhood in this film at all, in any way, shape, or form. She is an individual, and she changes and evolves. And if you watch very closely, as she grows more vulnerable, her appearance becomes less disheveled, and she loses some of the makeup. And there's the point where
she stops smoking, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there's the point where she's standing outside of the apartment or the house, the Paper Street house, and Jack is drunk, and she says, "Can I come in?" And he says, "Tyler's not here." And just the look of pain and hurt on her face because she thinks she's talking to Tyler, and Jack just doesn't realize that she is so vulnerable. And after that scene, the disheveled look is back, the makeup's back, she no longer looks like the person that came seeking love, affection, whatever it was, with her guard finally down. I mean, that's the thing, is she finally let all her guard down when she went there and didn't even get to talk to whom she thought was Tyler.
Well, and it's funny, too, because there's also the moment where... She calls because she thinks she might have felt a lump of breast cancer.
She goes to him.
But what is Jack's line? What does Jack say?
I'm safe.
I'm neutral.
Yeah, I'm neutral to her.
I'm neutral, okay.
So he completely misunderstands Marla completely.
Well,
he doesn't understand that that she's actually sincerely vulnerable in this moment, that she is calling him because she trusts him, even though she really shouldn't, let's be honest. Mm-hmm. And she's like, okay, I'm safe. She's feeling good. He did something nice for her. She's going to be tender with him, romantic. And he's just like, are we done here?
Yeah.
And the whole thing's completely ruined.
Well,
I think what's interesting about Marla is that she really likes Tyler. What was his last name?
Durden.
When he's accepting himself as Tyler Durden. Like, for example, I think Dave mentioned, when he said, "Tyler's not here, Tyler doesn't live here anymore," she walks away with that look of pain in her face, like, oh, this is Tyler Durden not accepting who he is. and they have their on and off relationship.
I think it might more be that. I mean, it's something like that. I mean, there's so many different ways you can read someone saying something like that, especially yeah. when they're known for being, you know, one way one moment and then such an asshole the next. Mm-hmm. I feel like basically what he. It might sound like a sort of a breakup thing. It might basically be like, you know,
don't come around.
The man you knew is gone.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I, well, I want to interrupt you, but if you got something else.
I'm going to let you finish, but.
I almost pulled a Kanye, the only black guy here almost pulled a Kanye West.
No, go ahead.
All right. I honestly think that that the relationship that they were having and the way it sort of like came to a head at that point where she's outside of the apartment, and just pretty much their relationship up until that breaking point was, it seemed to me a lot like a metaphor of the stereotypical relationship at the time and why things would end so badly.
Hmm.
How so?
There you got the alcohol, you got the sweet and tenderness one moment, and then the other moment they're just a complete asshole.
Not to mention, what is it but two broken people?
Yeah, two completely destroyed people that come together.
And what brings them together aside from the fact that they're broken together?
Yeah. They were perfect for each other in the sense that they were so imperfect themselves.
Yeah.
Well, and then at the end of the movie, sorry to interrupt you, Joe.
That's all good.
But when he shoots himself in the cheek, and she comes up, she's all worried about him. He's like, oh yeah, I'm fine, everything's fine.
She's pissed off, and then...
Yeah, she's like, what the hell did you do now?
Right. And then when the buildings are destructing in the background, she sees, oh, Tyler Burton's finally accepted himself for who he is, and then you should see the scene where they hold hands.
Which is so romantic.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, dude. That is like one of the best romantics. I got my fingers out and a little heart watching it on the screen. Because
Instagram!
There's blowing up! They're holding hands, and it's a guy and a girl holding hands, in love, watching buildings explode. That is so cool.
And people possibly dying.
Yeah. In Wilmington, so nobody cares.
You met me at a very strange point of my life.
Yeah.
It's almost enigmatic. Well, with everything that's going on.
But guess what?
Yeah, that's true.
Chuck Palahniuk's writing a sequel comic.
No, I don't understand that.
I don't understand.
We got to talk about how the book ended, because the book did not end on that point.
Another thing about the relationship. One of the things with the narration, I think, is that the narration actually obscures the disassociation between Jack and Tyler. Because, I mean, the whole movie, there's just one Tyler. But on the screen, we see the Calvin and Hobbes thing, where the tiger is a stuffed doll or a living thing that likes tuna fish sandwiches.
Oh, God.
Right? And the thing is, Waterston never resolved it. He never said, well, it's a real tiger, it's a stuffed doll. I mean, it literally is a Schrodinger's tiger. It's both.
So you're complicating my childhood, bro.
So the thing is, in the movie, that's what Jack is. He's both at the same time. So with Marla, she knows Tyler. So, oh, I can never win with you, can I? That was another one of that's part of the relationship.
Oh, yeah. Because like, she's the entire relationship.
What is your deal, man? I mean, it's like when he's downstairs, I could have gone up to the third floor, but I didn't. That was narration. While Jack is trying to sleep in his bed while they're doing their business on a different floor.
Jack not can't actually
them on a different floor.
Jack can't actually do anything. If you want to talk basically the personality switching, the changeover, as he calls it, Jack can't change over because he's too busy being Tyler Durden and banging Marla.
He's at that point where he feels the most
distant. He's lost his best friend.
Yeah.
I mean, that's part of it,
distant
too.
Distant while being, feeling like like a man in pure ecstasy for a bit.
You know what? Lost his best friend, and one of the reasons he beats up Babyface, because you could see Babyface is taking up, it looks like the possibility of taking up the mantle. Like, you see, even after they're leaving the hotel in that one scene, he claps Babyface on the back, you know, talks him a little bit. It looks like, basically, Babyface is getting set up to be another leader.
Kid brother.
Or something. Yeah. Like, he's replaced Jack as his best friend.
That's a good point. And
that's why he beats him up later.
And, you know, that may actually explain, and that's something I completely forgot I was going to mention, like, the reaction of the crowd when Jack is just beating his face in.
Like, nobody
saw it coming.
Yeah, nobody saw it coming.
When they realized what was happening.
And he broke a rule. I mean, like, he didn't stop when it was over.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He broke a rule, and then they're like, holy shit, this guy did something that we're not allowed to. He broke a rule.
But he's the one that gave them the rules.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In reality.
Yep.
So. And speaking of no one saw it coming, when each of you first saw the film, did you see coming that in reality Jack was Tyler Durden?
Nope.
Did anyone predict that at all?
I don't remember.
See, that was
they did a very good job of that unpredictability.
A lot of foreshadowing. A lot of
foreshadowing.
Oh, there's a lot.
It was so brief. I never see Tyler or Marla together.
Yeah.
They did. It's like the Clark Kent thing. Yeah.
But the narration, as you were saying, explains that away. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Doing the dance that my parents did. You know,
yeah, which obscures it.
Yeah. And there's that baby boomer parent issue again. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Through.
They plant that seed into the audience's head, but oh so quickly, and then the action picks right back up.
Yeah.
It goes from something, it was kind of like an important conversation happening to calm narration as, you know, as Marla leaves, and then Tyler comes in, and then the action picks back up. It gets, like, it breaks the pace for a very brief moment,
yeah,
and then gets right back on track.
And I will admit, there are some moments where it does feel like it kind of breaks or doesn't work. Like, the one scene that is most obvious when you go back and rewatch is when he's at the airport waiting for his luggage. And you watch Tyler Durden hop into the Ferrari or the convertible, drive off, and you see the guy run after it. But meanwhile, our hero Jack is still there in the airport,
and he's being emasculated. I mean, think about the conversation about the dildo.
Yes,
I mean, you know, sometimes it's a dildo, and
I don't have a dildo.
Yeah,
and it's
just
your
dildo. Guy's just like it's. We can't say the definite art. We have to use the definite article. A dildo. Indefinite article.
And yeah, it's
a
like,
dildo,
but I
not,
don't own
your. And he leans towards him and he looks right at him and says, "Your dildo." And he's like, "I don't have it." And he's like, "Shh, shh." And he waves his hands like, "I don't want to hear it. I don't want to hear it." It's just like, I know you have a dildo. And it's just the way he does it. And it's just like Jack's being emasculated while Tyler drives somebody else's car.
The phallic symbol. It was a Mustang.
Yeah, it's true.
There you go.
Yeah,
yep.
I mean,
convertible Mustang.
Yeah,
okay.
Red.
Yeah, again, he's driving a foul.
Big
yeah.
Red,
yeah,
big
good.
Red stands out, and yeah. It's something that every quote-unquote man wants.
And that's the thing, like, it's like, how is that supposed to work out technically, you know, logically?
But
who's
the thing
in control
is,
there, who's
yeah.
really there? And that's the thing, it could be whatever he's imagining with Tyler Durden isn't happening at all. It's all a figment of his imagination.
In fact, this whole
movie
could have been like that, honestly.
Yeah. Where the line between reality and fantasy is very unclear throughout the movie, too.
Very obscure.
But,
yeah.
And that's the
yeah.
thing. In a lot of ways,
it's like Perfect Blue, except Perfect Blue is a little bit more...
I think that movie.
I think he actually was making soap.
Yeah, I think he was actually making soap.
Yeah,
yes.
They actually kind of hinted when he was doing all this business traveling... He was leading a double life. He bought the house, started the business.
And that's the thing. Like he described, what was it, narcolepsy?
Yeah, but he doesn't describe narcolepsy.
He doesn't describe actual narcolepsy.
He describes going into a fugue state. You know,
yeah.
I fall asleep and I wake up in strange places. I don't remember how I got there.
That's
not like
narcolepsy.
A fugue state.
Schizophrenia. That sounds like a symptom of schizophrenia.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's not narcolepsy.
That's the thing. There are hints very early on, yeah.
That Tyler Durden has been there for a while. I mean, he had the house for a year. So, and why do you think Jack is so exhausted and he can't get any sleep, or he drifts off and everything's a copy of a copy? Well, he's actually been running around as Tyler Durden for quite some time.
And I'm there right after Tyler is.
Yeah. That's another thing.
On the bartender with the neck brace from the broken neck from Fight Club.
Oh, yeah.
You suppose Jack went off on him in that franchise also, like Babyface?
Possibly.
Mm-hmm. I don't know.
The dude looked really messed up.
He looked messed up,
yes.
True.
Mm-hmm. But it looks like a lot of that stuff had already healed. It probably went off
brace.
On him, but like...
Earlier.
What was the Fight Club that we know and saw in the movie?
Was
that
the
first
one,
yeah.
actually? Yeah.
Was that the first one?
Good
or had he
question.
Been franchising for a while?
Yeah.
That's another good question.
Especially since he went to all these... Jack went to all these areas as Jack, and they seem pretty well established.
Yeah.
And they, like, everything was exactly how it was in the Fight Club that we know.
Yeah.
Now, something I do want to mention, and I found this off of Wikipedia, as a sort of guarantee, well, not guarantee, as a sort of confirmation. David Fincher's early work as a director was in commercials for companies like Levi's, Converse, Nike, Pepsi, yeah. Revlon, Sony, Coca-Cola, and Chanel. Hmm. He did also do music videos, and I think both of these, the music video thing is just, you could tell in just about any film he makes, man. Because
the soundtrack editing was top rate.
The soundtrack, mm-hmm. He gets to do the soundtracks, and then how he blends it in with the film.
Yeah.
You could tell this guy made music videos.
Oh, the opening sequence?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, the opening mm-hmm. sequence. But even then, like, just how, like, you'll be watching, like, just anything. Like, him getting the shit beat out of himself.
Like, it's to the music.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's David Fincher really uses that, you know, early part of his career in his full film work very well. But in this film especially, I think he really called back to some of the kind of work. And honestly, like, I feel like you could take the moment. Like, I mean, Dave, once upon a time ago, I spoke with you about the scene where it's just randomly, in the middle of the film, Tyler Durden, as he's setting up Project Mayhem, is like, you are not your fucking khakis. You are not your job. You're not this. You're not that. He's turning around. He's looking at the audience. And then...
That's a Nike commercial.
It's not even Nike. It's a Pepsi commercial.
It's a commercial. Was it?
Yeah, that's right. Commercial.
No, just the very style of it.
It's a commercial.
Yeah. Not the
track, not literally a commercial.
The framing.
Exactly, the framing. And of course, and as you brought up to me when we spoke about it before, the way the film starts, you start to see the edges of the film reel.
It's like the film is getting breaking, caught in the projector or breaking.
It's breaking the fourth wall as all of a sudden, here's Tyler Durden's commercial for you. And it is in that edgy 90s in-your-face attitude that you would get out of a Levi's commercial, a Nike commercial, a Pepsi commercial, any of these things. Because, I mean, we see them even now. Like, I think Pepsi's trying to do this big ad about just how... I mean, it's all like, how does this stuff enrich your life? Kind of a thing.
Oh yeah,
like all of these
Pepsi generation.
Yeah.
Man,
Nike, Pepsi generation. Nike just do it.
Like you just And that's the thing. All of this is David Fincher is really implementing all of this, and I wonder if one of the reasons he chose this story. I'm wondering if one of the reasons David Fincher chose this story is because of that work he did making commercials and such, and therefore, because I said like very early on, like I didn't even think about it. You see, like, in the trash can, very early on, like, the camera pulls out of a trash can, and what do you see? You see, like, White Castle. You see Krispy Kreme.
Oh, yeah.
Product placement.
You see all kinds.
You see a McDonald's apple pie container.
Yeah, you see all these containers for all of these big-name products, and it's, like, setting the
stage.
They're
in the garbage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's showing his clear distaste.
while the narration is saying he expects the Mars mission to be sponsored by corporations.
Yeah, and this is 15
Starbucks
years ago.
Starbucks planet, yeah. Yeah,
this is 15 years
happening.
Ago, and that's
and
what
happening.
They're saying, yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. I'm wondering, especially from what you're saying, Fincher's work history is, how much of the project was autobiographical for him?
Yeah, because, I mean, a lot of the book, if I remember the story about how the book was written correctly, Chuck Palahniuk, and this is my memory and it could be flawed, but from what I recall, Chuck Palahniuk had lost his job. And he was driving, I think it was up the California coast, northward from Los Angeles. I don't remember. He might have been driving to LA. But I know he had to drive up the West Coast, I think. And the idea for the novel came to him then. Now, don't quote me on this. I could be wrong. This is how I remember the story.
Yeah, so the whole Delaware angle.
Yeah, actually, that's the thing I was going to...
Delaware City, yeah. Newcastle. Is the city being destroyed, Wilmington? Does it look like Wilmington?
They definitely... No.
A lot of the buildings do resemble the downtown. The streets are
downtown,
A lot of the streets are too broad and too long. Wilmington is a lot more compact than that.
Yeah, I went up and down 4th Street for an entire summer. That looked a lot nicer than I remember Wilmington.
Yeah, well, 10th and 12th, it's a little nicer down by the up by Rodney Square. But, I mean, the thing is, the glass towers, the credit card companies.
Make sure they're quiet.
Is it picking them up?
It could
be.
So yeah, there was that curious self-consciousness at the University of Delaware when the movie came out.
And that's actually the thing I was going to say.
Because Blue Hens consider Newark the armpit of the East Coast. There's nothing to do in Delaware. Wilmington shuts down at 6:30, all sorts of things. And then here's this this movie explaining what's wrong with Delaware. I mean, people in Delaware took the movie personally. They really identified with it.
Well, I mean, that's where all the credit card companies were.
Fortune 500s.
Yeah.
I mean, the white shirt, red tie, blue blazer uniform.
Yeah,
that's DuPont.
Dude, I was working at I went to get my first master's degree at the University of Delaware, and let me tell you, how many people there were in the MBA program, like the master's in business administration. They wanted to go and they wanted to work at the credit card companies up in Wilmington. Like, dead serious, man. That Fincher doesn't outright say that the movie takes place in Wilmington or the surrounding areas, but when they're talking about the towns that are, you know, where they're going and hitting the baseball bats in front of
the cars, yeah,
the cars to set the alarms off. It's like, I heard a fight club is open in Penns Grove,
Delaware City.
Oh yeah,
he said Delaware City.
Then he said Newcastle, and then somebody mentioned Penns Grove, which is funny because that's the New Jersey side. But yeah. You know that,
and Church Street, there are swaths of Wilmington that look like Church Street.
And aren't there paper mills in Northern Delaware? I mean, they have Paper Mill Road.
Well, there was in Newark.
Yeah,
not really. But yeah. the smells, the chemical plants near Wilmington, do have the smells that he describes in the movie.
Yeah, yeah. The book wasn't set in Delaware. The book could have been set anywhere.
Okay, because I was going to say,
the book was not set in any specific place.
I was going to say, if Palahniuk was really, driving up and down the California coast, and then it's like, well, I guess if you want to make a movie about people that are unsatisfied with their work, you're doing
Wayne's
Delaware.
World. Wayne's World.
Yeah,
exactly. But we're in Delaware.
Yeah. The ending, though.
Isn't that in Pennsylvania?
The ending, though, of the book is so different, because in the book, he ends up in an insane asylum. And it's funny because the scene where Tyler is talking about how our fathers are our models for God, one, that is very true for men. Our fathers, we have a tendency to imagine God very much like we
experienced
our fathers. And whether, I mean, for good or for ill, which puts a lot of responsibility on your dads. At the end of the movie, at the end of the book, he's in an insane asylum, and he goes and he sits in and he says, yeah, I got to sit in front of God. And he sat there with his big white beard, sitting at his beautiful oak desk with all his diplomas on his wall. And you're like, wait, he's not talking to God. He's talking to a psychiatrist. Like, the reader knows this, but Jack doesn't. And so,
wow.
Yeah, he says,
interesting.
Jack, the God, quote unquote, says, but don't you know, everybody really is a special, unique little snowflake. And and Jack says, whatever, man, you can't tell God anything.
And here's the funny thing, though. I mean, as funny as an ending as that is, and it sounds like an ending that might have worked for the book, I'm not sure I could see that working for the film.
Nay, neither could I. I mean, it worked really well for the book.
The
author actually preferred the movie ending, if I recall correctly.
Really?
I might be remembering it wrong, but I remember... Huh. Praising the movie.
The distinction, the difference, I mean, accepting that Palahniuk actually preferred the movie ending over his own written ending, honestly, the movie ending feels more like an inverted trope of a Hollywood ending, a happy ending.
Yeah, it does.
Prince Charming gets the girl, and he succeeds at his task.
Meanwhile, the world around him is just being... He's watching it.
He did not save the world.
No, but that's just it. He did save the world. That was the whole point of destroying the credit card records, because all the debt was wiped out. So it's a jubilee.
Yes and no.
All the debt is wiped out.
Because remember, because Tyler Durden, that's the thing. Like, this is the first time before Tyler Durden really leaves for Project Man, before he leaves Jack, when Jack's in his bed. What's he talking about? And he's basically talking about New York City overgrown with ivy and people farming on what were once highways.
Yeah, laying out strips of venison,
yeah, but what did
pounding
he, and
corn.
What he wants to do, I mean, when he says he wants to go back to zero, he literally wants to go back to that hunter-gatherer nature.
Because he is anti-civilization.
Which again, is the typical understanding of the Übermensch, of Nietzsche's whole point, the being the nihilist.
Mm-hmm.
But...
And okay. It's funny because...
Okay.
And,
I can buy that.
And but. Here's and that's another thing, too, because when you also jump back to... What are the people doing when Marla comes around? They're farming and tilling that waste of a field in front of his house.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a complete dilapidated mess, and they're trying to beautify it.
They've set up a greenhouse there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the, and that's another thing you can even talk about when it comes to your work. And, like, what are these guys doing in Project Mayhem? Well, part of it is the destruction, but at the same time, what's the everyday work they're doing? Well... At the very least, even if they're farming and stuff like that, like it might be work where you see the fruits of your labor.
But they're farming a toxic waste dump.
Yeah.
Yeah, but they're farming something. And there's grass coming out of the ground. I mean, and that's the thing. What was Jack really seeing with his job, his contribution to the company?
Killing people.
Yeah, he was saving the company money. Yeah, exactly. He was so the company could save money. I mean, and that was his contribution to society. Something that, in a lot of ways, in and of itself, is uncivilized and antisocial.
And kind of evil, considering what's... Basically, it's like, what's cheaper, you know, a settlement out of court or...
The recall.
And that means if a settlement out of court is cheaper, then there's dangerous equipment still out there and people could still be killed.
And he finally confronts that with his boss.
Yep. He does, but the thing is, basically, it's still technically kind of evil, because basically he extorts his boss.
Yeah, blackmail.
It's, you know, I'm finding, like, I find a lot of parallels in how we go back to square one. Like, everything comes back full effing circle. His company also run, like, the company that he worked for... also runs parallel with his own life. Who's the good guy? Who's the bad guy? Like, well, here's what we do, and it looks like we do this, but really, when you go to its core, there's some really shady, nasty crap going on.
Yeah.
Same with it goes directly in line with Jack versus Tyler, and really, like, because he's all about.
What does Jack think they're doing versus what is Tyler really doing?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, and and on top of that, like, I find that, yeah, they're, like, Tyler acted like a leader. He's like, all right, you gotta take the power into your own hands. Join me. Follow me. And then they all throw away their names to follow this new leader of theirs and do his bidding. And they all end up doing... what seems to be like factory work. They become cogs in their own system that they've created, which is just like society in general. Yeah,
but there's one thing that they have that they didn't before, and that's that camaraderie, and that's that personal relationship with their leader to whom they can look up.
Yeah, they saw some purpose behind it, so they kept going with it.
I mean, what's sad is that the system. I mean, granted, this is a work of fiction, so, like, you know, and I have worked in the corporate sector, not actually as a white collar, but I have worked for companies doing labor, and I had bosses for whom I would have broken my back because they were just that good, that personal, so it's not like it doesn't actually happen in real life.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, in the world of the novel and the film, you know, the bosses, I mean, compare Tyler Durden to Jack's boss.
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like,
it's
the
like
man, the man is just, the man himself is emasculated.
He's a corporate toady.
Yes, oh, yeah. He is. Yeah, absolutely.
That's why he describes the cornflower tie or the yellow tie.
Mm-hmm.
They're completely characterless.
Yes.
They're cookie cutter.
Another parallel between the two different jobs, though, is the, going back a little bit, is covering up the evil stuff. When Robert Paulson was killed, there instantly we have to cover up the evidence. The same as with him going to the scene with the recalls, they were covering up the evidence.
Mm. Yeah. The interesting thing, though, about that is, though, I mean, and there's a difference. The Robert Paulson was mourned and immortalized. And again, these simple things, I mean... Mm.
Through a misunderstanding.
Well, yes, through a misunderstanding.
In a very cultist way.
Yeah,
but was Robert Paulson immortalized, or was the man that the first man that died for Project Mayhem immortalized?
Well, I think it was any man that died. The way the guy's... Yeah. I understand. Yeah. Now when he dies, he gets a name.
Mm-hmm. So now he is Robert Paulson.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's the thing, though, is what Robert Paulson started out as an emasculated man with no testicles and bitch tits in the film. That's when he's introduced to us. And when he dies, he has a name. But I mean, this is some almost like some Mircea Eliade level, like freaking shit, you know, with like Sacred and Profane. Like he has been, he is no longer mundane. He is part now of sacred space and sacred time. He is beyond, by dying for Project Mayhem, he has become holy. And yes. He
was the sacrificial lamb.
Well, it's not just that he was a sacrificial lamb. That is part of the setup too. But you know, and that's the whole thing. Like Tyler is talking about, like, you know, we owe civilization to soap, and we owe soap to the fact that there were human sacrifices up on the hill, and the great thick soapy discharge. And a lot of this is kind of anthropologically and, you know, historically speaking. But like the gist is clear where he's going with this is the human sacrifices played a necessary role. The space monkeys played a necessary role in, you know, the space race. Hence, that's why he creates the human sacrifices, the space monkeys for Project Mayhem.
That's what they're labeled when he closes the door and you see all their driver's
licenses.
It's labeled human sacrifices.
And Robert Paulson now, though, has become... He has gone from being somebody who is like... I wouldn't even say no a zero, because he's actually in the negatives when the movie begins. And when the movie ends, he is holy. He is sacrosanct. He will be remembered. His name won't be spoken like anybody else's name. His name is spoken.
His name is a sacrament.
Exactly. His name in and of itself is liturgy now.
The funny thing, too, is that he's actually been redeemed. Remember what they said when he was before he had to circulate cancer? He was a power lifter or something like that,
yeah.
Wasn't he?
Yeah.
Steroids.
Steroids.
He was trying to find masculinity and in that sense of, like, you know, of that physical power and prowess. Mm-hmm. And then...
Consumerism.
Yes.
Yeah. Exactly.
And that's what fried his balls,
mm-hmm.
so yep. to speak.
And then he found that, I guess in this case, it's not really so much, it wasn't reclaimed, it was a little bit of redemption, really. The funny thing, too, is that if you remember, he almost didn't even make it into this either.
Yeah.
There was...
Yep.
And how did he make it in?
Because it was Jack who brought him back, who encouraged him and pulled him back. Which, in the end...
Got him killed.
Yeah, which got him killed.
And what did Jack say about putting the phone back on the receiver instead of going to watch Marla kill herself? Completely changed his life?
Yeah.
That's what led Tyler to go bring her home. But it was actually...
Because Tyler's the impulsive one. Like, Tyler's the one... Because
right.
What is Jack really struggling with? I mean, from the very get-go, even though he's very frustrated with Marla, he's also sexually attracted to her.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Hence when
from
he goes to... He goes into his happy place with the penguin, and instead of the penguin, Marla's mysteriously there. And he thinks it's a point of frustration. And, you know...
Sexual frustration, definitely.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Even if it is frustration, there's also the sexual frustration that's going on. And so, like, but he... Like, for him, he's still tied to society's ideas of, well, what's normal? Technically, he shouldn't go after someone like Marla. Because
she's a basket case.
And yet, you have Tyler, who's like, well, screw it, I'm attracted to her, let's go.
Yeah.
One thing I just realized is, just random tangent, and when he's in the cave, the penguin and she both say slide. His subconscious was telling him from the beginning to let go, you know, to slide down the rock.
Slide, yeah.
Or slide down the side of the hill when you hit another car. I mean, that whole thing is exactly what happens when Tyler tells him to let go and they have the near-life experience when they're in the car. They slide down the hill. They don't fall. They don't. Well, they roll a little bit, but a lot. The cars both slide down the hill.
You still have to let go of any type of sense of control. You have to just let gravity take you, and you might be able to maneuver yourself a little bit as you're going down. But you're just you can't do anything.
But that idea of control over your life is one of the big themes, because that's why does Jack beat the crap out of Babyface? Because it gives him he has control over something, he has agency over something, and that agency is whether or not he destroys something beautiful in this case. And that's the thing. Like, a lot of this stuff is these men are emasculated because they no longer have control. And what Tyler is saying is, like you said, let go. Let go of the control.
And with that, I think it is time for me to wrap this up, because we went on quite a bit, and the shame of it is, I think we could keep talking about it.
Oh, yes.
It is that kind of movie.
And it is that kind of director. So I do definitely intend to do more David Fincher movies in the future.
I'm not opposed.
Second motion.
I know the next Norwood Film Club we're going to have will be Scott Pilgrim vs. the World. That will probably be around March 22nd should be the air date for that podcast. But I can't really make any promises. I do have a few things in store for the next couple of weeks, but until then, I am your host, Chris Cesarano, and saying goodbye, our Dave.
Dave Cesarano.
Jose Bellotero.
And the Droogs.
Ciao.
All right, thank you for joining us, guys, and I hope you'll keep joining in for more Norwood Film Club and for my video game discussion.
Sober this time.
Sober this time.
Ooh. Yeah, my goodness.
For more discussions on film and video games like this, subscribe to the Ramblecast on iTunes, or visit www.gamertag.net and find direct download and RSS feed links for the Ramblecast. In addition, you will also find plenty of blog posts written by me, Chris Cesarano. You can also find more of my writing at www.gamerswithjobs.com, and find plenty of my videos at youtube.com/user/ramblepack64.
My dad never went to college, so it's real important that I go.
Sounds familiar.
So I graduate. I call him up long distance. I said, Dad, now what? He says, get a job.
Same here.
Now I'm 25. Make my yearly call again. I say, Dad, now what? He says, I don't know. Get married.
You can't get married. I'm a 30-year-old boy.
We're a generation of men raised by women. I'm wondering if another woman is really the answer we need.
That's the thing, going back to some of what Dave was saying, going back to what my Droog was saying.
Yeah, there's two Daves in here.
To keep this from being a little too confusing.
There's another one in the other room. Yeah.
Dave's everywhere.
It's a good name.
But no, to go back, shit.
Uh-oh.
Oh,
self-loathing.
Yeah, we're going to edit this section.
No, don't edit it. It'll be funny.
Director of the movie was named Dave, by the way.
Oh, yeah. David Fincher.
I think we're living Fight Club right now, because there's three Daves. Yeah. They're all the same person.
And they all hate himself.
They're beating the crap out of each other right now.
So thanks for helping me get back on track, man.
Yeah. So you know,
I got a general idea of.